You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. In Milwaukee and in cities around the country, there's often a cultural mismatch between students and their teachers. A report last year from the Public Policy Forum found that 10% of Milwaukee teachers were from minority groups, while 44% of students are people of color. And research from the American Federation of Teachers found that in urban areas around the country, there was a decline in the number of minority teachers. So many of the people teaching in schools in lower-income urban areas, with many people of color, are white. Often they're from middle-class backgrounds. And our next guest says even for teachers with the best of intentions, these cultural differences can be a major obstacle unless we rethink the way we teach. Christopher Emden joins us now. He's an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at Teachers College at Columbia University. He was the 2015 Multicultural Educator of the Year, awarded by the National Association of Multicultural Educators. His new book is called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, before we get into the advice in your book, some people might think, hey, teachers are teachers, students are students, standards are standards, no matter what people's background. So why should we be paying more attention to, you know, the cultural backgrounds of students and their teachers?
Because everything that you just said is actually so far from sort of legitimate when we look at the reality of schools. So if we say teachers are just teachers and students are just students, then we have to ask questions about why is it that particular populations consistently are not doing as well as their counterparts. If we can believe that all students have the same sort of academic abilities and same skill sets and same strengths, and they're able to prove those skill sets and strengths when they're outside of school, then the issue has to be something about the context of schools. Now, I'm not saying the issue is necessarily just resting at the fact that there are sort of these cultural differences between students and teachers alone. However, it is an elephant in the room that we don't address and we have not addressed, and I believe that starting there is a way forward.
And it seems like a lot of times there's more and more of a cookie-cutter approach where all teachers should teach the same material in the same way, or some other people might say, here's the way to be successful as a teacher in an urban neighborhood. As I look through your book, it seems like you're saying the key is to see the students as individuals and fit their individual strengths, weaknesses, interests into the way the classroom works.
Absolutely. Well, if there's one thing that we know about education, for anybody who is sort of in classrooms, working in classrooms, or conducting research in real classrooms, we know that the way that education is sort of played out from a larger, more policy standards perspective is this idea of making everything uniform. But this uniform nature of how we are expected to teach runs counter to everything that we know about teaching. So the best teaching is deeply personalized. It does focus on the ways of knowing and being and understanding and culture of the young people. And so if you're imposing an approach to teaching and learning that is very uniform, that's extracted from your culture, then it serves as an additional barrier to you being able to sort of be fully actualized in the classroom. It serves as a barrier for a teacher to be effective. And so what I'm laying out here is an approach to teaching and learning that gives teachers an opportunity to be able to have a tool for sort of interrogating youth culture and then a mechanism for using what comes out of their study of the culture to be more effective in their teaching.
And one problem you're trying to solve is that a teacher or somebody observing from the outside comes in with assumptions about the kids in a classroom. If we're thinking about African-American youth in a high school, say, we have assumptions about that, and we can misinterpret behavior as being disconnected or acting out. And you talk about video examples of this. How does that happen? How does that play out in the classroom?
So what I do in the book is I really lay out a bunch of stories and a bunch of anecdotes of things that I've witnessed firsthand being in classrooms where a teacher will perceive a student as enacting a behavior that she thinks is suspension worthy, and then we have a conversation with the student and you realize the student actually really wants to be in that classroom and really wants to learn. And there's this huge gap between what the teacher thinks and what the student is experiencing. There have been all other scenarios where, you know, the student is enacting a behavior that actually is a marker of sort of interest and sort of jumping out of their seat because they can't wait to learn more, and a teacher perceives that as being disruptive. And so, you know, we come into urban spaces oftentimes based on our own norms. To be just completely frank and honest, white middle-class norms for folks who are socioeconomically advantaged are just very different than what the norms are for young people of color in urban communities. Just the nature of exchange is different. And so part of what I sort of lay out here is how does the teacher learn how to identify these phenomena that may be misperceived as disinterested in education, when in reality, they may be a trigger for having kids actually really fully engaged. And I do so, again, through story, but I also do so by couching that description in research and firsthand experience.
Well, I want to get to a firsthand experience you had, not as a teacher or a researcher, but when you were in 10th grade, you had a really dramatic example of getting in trouble based on an assumption about your behavior. Can you tell that
story?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's one of the most striking stories that I try to share in the book. I remember, growing up in an urban community that was, challenging in many respects. And I ended up, going into my apartment building as a young man, and there was a shootout. And I froze. I stood just, froze because the whole entire experience scared me. When I got home, I spoke to my mom, and my sister was describing what happened. And my mom said, "Chris, when if something like that ever happens again, you can't afford to just freeze. I mean, you have to duck, you have to hit the floor. If you're on the floor, it's less likely for you to actually get shot." And I took her advice to heart. And I get into school, I'm in the classroom, the teacher is teaching, and as we're teaching, a loud noise comes from the hallway, probably a door slamming or something to that effect. And for me, immediately it triggered this gunshot moment, and I jumped underneath the table. and in jumping underneath the table, the teacher walked up to my desk and misperceived my reaction to the sound as me being purposely being a class clown or being disruptive, when in reality it was really, a traumatic experience that I was reliving. And in response to that, sort of like that misunderstanding of that experience, all I could do was just play like I didn't care. I laughed. The class laughed it off. I smiled it off. I walked out of the classroom, out of the hallway. That triggers a kind of relationship with that teacher, who did not understand the fact that my response in that moment was not me being a class clown, was not me not wanting to learn, but rather a response to an experience that I just had a visceral, almost emotional, psychological response to. And for me, those kind of moments are trauma. And in the book, I talk about this idea of how young people experience trauma every day that teachers cannot recognize. And when somebody's experiencing trauma and you don't recognize it, then they suffer in that classroom. They can't learn in that classroom. And so in the book, I sort of play out these type of scenarios and help guide teachers through this process, but also help guide other folks who are interested in education, whether you're just an outside party or a stakeholder or on a school board or a parent. How do you help the teacher to be able to make sense of the experiences of young people of color?
Talking to Christopher Emden. His new book is called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. He's helping bridge a lot of cultural gaps, a lot of misunderstanding in classrooms. And I want to get into the classroom now, Chris. You give a lot of strategies, ways to bring students on board in some ways. And I want to start with a concept you call, I think it's co-generation, where the teacher works with the students in a way to create the curriculum or what happens on a day-to-day basis. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. And if I may, a lot of people who work in urban education or describe what's happening in urban education do a really good job at describing what's wrong and describing the issues with the teachers and describing the statistics. And I made it a point in this book to give solutions. And each chapter is filled with solutions. And so this dialogue that you're describing, what I call the co-generative dialogue, essentially is having the teacher create a moment or a set of spaces where they can engage with three or four students about the classroom and how those kids are experiencing the classroom, and then co-constructing a method for teaching appropriately based on those students' feedback. It really is a simple process, but that goes a long way. So in my research, I've had young people tell teachers about things that the teacher would not have recognized. The fact that you only stand next to the smart kids, and a teacher says, "Well, I think you're all smart, but the students are experiencing the fact that you're only privileging certain students in the classroom." And so now they can help you to be able to rethink the process of what you do in the classroom. And part of the entire process that I outlined is how do you empower young people to be a part of the teaching and learning process, not just as passive learners, but active engagers in the process, almost partners with the teacher to make the class run more efficiently.
And you have to be pretty humble as a teacher to do that, I think, and be willing to relinquish some authority. And you experienced this yourself as a teacher. You did this co-generation where your students said, it makes us uncomfortable when you raised your voice, and you do it a lot.
Yeah, I think this is also important to note. You know, the title of the book is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, but it's also for the rest of y'all, too. So I speak from a vantage point also as a man of color in schools with young folks of color, and them telling me what they need from me to be more effective, and my unwillingness to shift because I think that they're just, you know, they're just being mean or they're just being critical for no reason. And then I can only imagine a person who does not look like these kids, who's not from the same community, who does not speak the same language, who comes from a different socioeconomic background. If I, who has a deep connected and embeddedness in that community, can have that kind of experience, you could only imagine that for somebody who doesn't. And so, not only does it require humility, but it also requires an understanding that you are always learning as a teacher, and that the students are the ones who are going to teach you. And it requires you being willing to be an active learner about the students' lives before you can be effective. And not only in a sort of philosophical way, but in a way where there are strategies to help you do that.
Talking to Christopher Emden. His new book is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all, too. He says we need to pay attention to cultural differences between teachers and students, make the classroom a friendlier place for students from all backgrounds. He's sharing some ideas, some strategies even, on how to do that. We'll get into some more of his advice in just a few minutes. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your stories and your questions. If you have experience with these cultural differences in the classroom as a parent, a student, a teacher, and an administrator, share your perspective. How can we bridge these gaps? How did you try to bridge them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Christopher Emden. His new book is called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. He's sharing advice to help reach across cultural boundaries in schools, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this in person as a student, a teacher, or a parent? What worked, what didn't work when the teacher was from a different background, different culture than the students? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Chris, another idea you talk about in the book is co-teaching, bringing the students on board, I guess, to help teach a subject. How would that play out?
Yeah, you know, one of the most sort of fascinating things that I find is when young people who have been identified as troublemakers or identified as disinterested in school are given the opportunity to lead the conversation. When they're given the chance to actually go home, design a lesson, bring it back to class, study the content, and then deliver that information. And once young people are given the opportunity to do that, there are things about how they engage with each other that actually gives the teachers strategies to be more effective. And so co-teaching, you know, as I laid out in the book, is an approach to teaching and learning, not where you have, you know, two adults and one gets the copies or whatever else it is, but rather one where young people are empowered to be able to take ownership over the teaching and learning and the distribution of information. And the only time that a teacher gets in the way of the kids actually teaching is if the content is off. And in this way, the teacher simply becomes a sideline participant in the teaching and learning process while the learning is active for young folks and young folks of color in particular. And what's fascinating about co-teaching is that in the best schools, for most socioeconomically advantaged communities, the best and top private schools in the nation, this is a part of what they do every day. Young people are empowered. They're allowed to teach. They're allowed to lead the instruction. What we find in schools that are more socioeconomically disadvantaged or where they have a majority youth of color, the approaches to teaching and learning are a lot more regimented and a lot more strict and a lot more structured. And what I make the argument for is that if you loosen the structure to reflect what we know is best practice for everyone, you would be surprised at how the young people who've been described as disinterested actually become engaged and become empowered.
That reminds me, you say in the book that you think there's too much attention paid to having the perfect lesson plan in place, to maintaining the right level of discipline in the class, and not to creating this positive, I guess, interactive environment with the students.
Listen, we all know that for a teacher to be effective, or for anybody who's presenting to a larger or wide audience to be effective, they have to have planned their work. They should have structured what it is that they want to do. However, Following a script runs counter to everything that we know about teaching and learning for the most marginalized populations and also for all populations. If a teacher goes in there and has all 40 minutes of their lesson designed to a T and knows what's going to happen by the 2-minute and 34-second mark and knows what's going to happen by the 38-minute and 24-second mark, that teacher is not going to be as effective as a teacher who understands how to receive the information from the student, take the energy from what the students are giving them, and then maneuver the teaching to be able to meet their goals. You want to keep your academic goals intact. You want to know, I want to make sure at the end of this lesson the kids understand genetics or they understand how to balance equations. But the path towards balancing equations or doing genetics is oftentimes not found in the script. It's found in your ability as an educator to be able to leave the script behind in the interest of ensuring that your students are with you. So I've taught in schools or follow teachers around who are so committed to their lesson plan, so committed to their textbook, so committed to what the district hands them that they are ineffective because young people are bored to death half the time because you're spending the whole darn class following a script instead of actually teaching.
I remember in school a couple times the teachers let us play Jeopardy, but themed, you know, along whatever, the social studies, science, whatever it was. And I thought, all right, we're slacking off, having some fun here. But you write that the teacher's actually tricking us. We actually were learning pretty effectively by playing Jeopardy.
You know, I've been in schools all across the country, and teachers will play Jeopardy when they're trying to prepare their students for a test. And you see the joy in the classroom. The kids are engaged. They're raising their hands. They're having fun. They're competing with their peers. And they're learning content. And this probably happens maybe, you know, 3 days before the test when a teacher's just trying to make sure that they know what's going on. Why do we wait for 3 days before the test to do the stuff that the kids are enjoying? Why can't you create a structure like Jeopardy or Jeopardy more consistently or academic games more consistently? And I know what folks are thinking. Oh, so Emden is saying don't be academically rigorous. It is a fallacy. It's a lie that to have fun and play an academic game lacks academic or intellectual rigor. I can maintain my academic rigor while kids are having fun at the exact same time. And the way that the system is structured thus far, particularly for young people of color, is to extract out anything that might be in any semblance that they have some kind of expression of joy in the classroom. Well, the best psychological research, the best academic research lets us know that if young people have positive emotions around the learning experience, they're more likely to retain the information. And if we do the opposite, where they don't have positive experiences around the learning experience, they're less likely to learn the information. So I'm not reinventing the wheel here. I'm just bringing back up what we fundamentally know is true and right to do, and then presenting it in a way where it meets the needs for a very particular population.
Talking about teaching with Christopher Emden. His book is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. Following up on the Jeopardy idea, Chris, I know you're a big fan of, and you've got a chapter on it, competition as a way to get kids excited about what they're learning. What kind of things, apart from that game of Jeopardy, will work?
Oh man, competition just around the ways that you present information in class. You know, not just on a written exam, but who can create the best poem about a science concept? Who can create the best interpretive dance about the process of balancing equations? You know, how can we have class A in the morning compete with class B on who can have the higher average on an examination or a presentation where they all know about it and they all kind of one up each other? But it's not competition in the sense of, you know, it's a high stakes competition and if you lose it's doom and gloom. It's competition in the sense that let us enjoy the process together and make the entire process almost gamified, right? And so when I talk about competition, I talk about the art of friendly competition. I talk about the art of competing with somebody with a larger goal of each of you being better. And in the book, I give an example of capoeira, for example, that looks like two folks are actually fighting, but in reality, they're sharpening their skill set that can be used to fight. And I think that if educators are more deliberate about how we use the magic of competition to be an anchor for how we get youth to be able to engage and be invested in what's going on in the classroom, we'd be better served.
Big picture, Chris, you've got a lot of ideas. They sound like fun, but who makes it happen? Does it take a cadre of superhero teachers? Who's going to put this into place?
I firmly believe that it requires everyone. I do believe that the classroom is ground zero for changing teaching and learning in this country, particularly for populations who have been, you know, traditionally sort of underserved. I think that if we have a cadre of teachers who just believe in the art and craft of teaching again, that we would be better served. But I also think it requires parents who have expectations of teaching to be engaging to their young people. It also requires school board members to say, listen, I know that for us to be able to do this right, we have to have conversations with teachers about what it is that we feel should be best for students. So, you know, what I'm arguing for here is using the classroom as the fundamental place from which transformative education happens, with investment from everybody who's a stakeholder in education.
Very briefly, Chris, as we wrap up, when you talk to teachers and administrators, are they excited about what you're talking about?
You know, I get some folks who are so excited they're jumping out of their skin, and then I have some folks who are so offended. You know, the title of my book is, you know, For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. Somebody is listening to your station right now and was going to call in and heard that the title of the book was For White Folks, and the minute I say white folks, they perceive me to be a racist, or they perceive me to, you know, to be purposely talking about race issues because I want to create some angst within communities. No, I'm talking about For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, because the majority of folks who teach in the hood are white folks, and I need white folks to be able to understand how to teach young people of color better. So it's not that I'm trying to push white folks out of the community or make them feel bad about being ineffective. It's saying you are here in this community. You're probably there because you care about this community. Now, how can we work together to ensure that we're doing what's right by young people? So the responses have been varied. Whether folks love this work, they're implementing some of the strategies already and saying, oh my gosh, this is working. I can't believe that you're suggesting something and it's actually working with these kids who've never been engaging with me. Or folks who say,
well, we've got to leave it there. Thanks to Christopher Emden. His new book is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too.